You were listening to the Never Meet Your Heroes podcast, conversations with artists about their work and inspiration. I am your host, Anthony Moses Sanchez. Today I have artist Angel Villanueva. So Angel, why don't you
The fabulous Angel Villanueva.
Go ahead and introduce yourself by letting us know where you're from, your origin story, how you became Thumbelina. Tell us how you became the Black Swan.
I have a really interesting origin story. As a matter of fact, my mom and my dad, they met. They were illegal immigrants here, dad was my mom's coyote. He got her across the border, and that's how they met.
You know? Explain coyotes in case someone's not American.
That's the person that guides immigrants through the border, you know, and avoiding the border patrol and, you know, finding the back roads. She came into the U.S. through, like, the brush, you know, somewhere outside of Tijuana. Mm-hmm. And
In Mexico is your mom from?
She was born in Nayarit, but grew up in Baja California. My grandfather and grandmother, they migrated north because of the agricultural explosion in Baja, so they came mm-hmm. looking for work. And unfortunately, my grandfather died when she was about 3 years old, that's another story for another time. But essentially, I was born here in California and was taken back to Mexico when I was about 2 months old, and grew up there until I finished high school in Mexico. By the time I turned 18, I was living in Guadalajara, which is an everything city. It's an amazing place, and it was kind of scary at the time when I lived there, you know, because of the drug war.
What year was that then?
1995, and so that's when I turned 18, and I fled, essentially. I was in college there. I was studying at Instituto Tecnológico de Monterrey, Campus Guadalajara. And I was actually studying...
Shout out. What?
I was studying computer engineering. And it was the first semester, and I just fled. I just left, and I came here. And so that's kind of my origin of my identity as an artist. I mean, I started painting when I was 7. And I had been drawing since I could crawl, you know. Mm-hmm. I was 7 years old when I pestered my mother for watercolors, and she did get them for me on my 7th birthday, and that was pretty much it. I started painting, and I never had any formal training in art until I went to college. You know, by the time I went to college, I was pretty good at drawing. I had already painted public murals. I was 17 when I did the first one in a library in Mexico, and it's just something that always fascinated me. But as I was in during my teenage years, it was when I lost my mother. My mother raised me by herself pretty much. And she got really ill when I was 12, you know, so she could no longer take care of me. I essentially grew up unsupervised from the age of 12 and up. I mean, I did live with my family and whatnot, but so I took to drawing as a kind of a therapy. You know, I would draw every night diligently. I still have all my drawings, by the way. You should look at them later, because they're not easy things to look at. They're pretty raw, you know.
Right.
And but it was really cathartic, you know. Like that's how I dealt with the world, and that's how I understood on a really visceral level what art can do, not necessarily for the audience, but for the artist himself. You know, it allows you to manifest the things that you don't quite understand, and it allows you to materialize them and behold them in front of you and deal with them. I understood that the role, and it really cemented my sort of commitment. I mean, I was in high school, I was a science champion. I always thought that I was going to be a scientist, and actually my dream was that, to be a physicist or to be a mechanical engineer, somebody working on aviation industry or aerospace or something like that. That's where I saw myself going the whole time while I was growing up. And I think I would have been good at it. But it's like art is a jealous lover. You can't just toss it aside, you know? Mm-hmm. So by the time I started, because I started college here in a really sort of tentative way once I came to live in the U.S.
When did you come to the U.S.?
December of 1995. But I didn't start college until much later. I think it was 1997, the fall of 97. Mm-hmm. And my intent, again, was to go into the sciences. But then I went and I took like art classes, you know, for general ed, and that was like, oh God, there was a semester where I had like a almost a breakdown. I'm like, I can't keep doing this. This is ridiculous. You know, like, mm-hmm. I have to pick one of the two. It was obvious. I wasn't going to be able to do both and be good at both, you know? So
was there a particular class or a particular moment in the class where you realized this is my passion now?
Well, yes, because there was this one instructor that, and this is why good art instruction is important. There was this one instructor that really pushed my drawing to like a level that I wasn't unaware that I was even capable of. And I surprised myself, you know, I didn't expect that. And he taught me how to see rather than how to draw, you know, and how to analyze an object, how to understand how it sits and how it occupies space, you know, how it reflects light, how it casts a shadow. And this is pretty standard instruction, mind you, very, very standard in figurative art. But he was particularly good at pointing out what I was, you know, instead of just giving me a critique of the drawing itself. He would give me a critique of how I was looking at the object. You know, like, this is what you're not seeing, but do you see it? It's right there, you know. So it's kind of ironic that I've become an art instructor myself, you know, and I am able to bring this to my students as much as I can, you know.
Like, so you're teaching now in Claremont for about 3 or 4 years?
In Pomona, at the Dozen for the Arts. I teach the painting class there on the weekends. And this is my third year teaching. And so in any case, you know, I took some more art courses. I got my transfer credits at went to Manzac. And then from there, I transferred to Pitzer College, and that's where I finished my bachelor in art and art history. I'm a dual major. I think probably the most valuable and most transformative thing that I've studied formally within an academic setting has been ancient world history and the understanding of the emergence of art. It always takes place, and I feel, in its most authentic form when humans are dealing with the unknown. And they're able to sort of manifest their doubts and their understanding and their grasp and externalize it and reflect upon it by gazing upon it. That made me feel connected to the root of culture, you know, to understand at least some of the impulses that created the great works of art of the ancient world.
Well, when we talked about your art schooling and stuff, was there any particular artist, even going back to when you're seven? I feel like a lot of people kind of experiment with different arts, but beyond, was there any artist that kind of you like to emulate or you've been
visually
impressed by?
Yes, yes.
And I know you've traveled to Italy too, so you've probably got a lot of.
Yeah, there's been a number of them, but there's never been somebody that I like, a visual artist that I. That makes paintings, let's say, that I idolize. Hmm. Not quite. It's more of an amalgam of a certain grouping of people.
Well, I think ideally all arts, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants,
yes.
That you're synthesizing different forms, yeah. That interest you.
The one that I think I got the most literally obsessed with at some point was Vermeer. Because In 2010, when I traveled through Europe, you know, I did a privately funded artist residency in Italy, but I was able to travel before and after that. You know, I started in Washington D.C., and that's where I ran into my first Vermeer, the woman holding a valance. Wow! I mean, just the technique. It's so masterful. It's so careful. It's so you have to see it in person, obviously. Mm-hmm. I would find out later. Paintings that have lots of glazes in them are incredibly difficult to photograph. You cannot convey in a photograph the luminosity and the translucency of the pigment and all that. And so since I was doing a sort of a tour of European museums after that, I went and I studied every single Vermeer I could get my hands on. You know, there was a
much to the chagrin of the security.
Yes, you know, there was in D.C., there was... I stood in front of that painting for 5 hours, you know, and because you can photograph the paintings there, and I have photographs of every square inch of it, you know, as close as I could get, so I could get a great mosaic of it. And
they're like, this guy's tripping balls.
Yes. Yeah, no, seriously, there was this, they put a security guard at the entrance of this one room where this painting is, like, it's like this, because, you know, people are crazy. I mean, they'll do crazy things, so they were just watching me. So then at the end, once I took all my notes and everything, and I went, I told him, hey, I'm sorry, I'm not, you know, I'm not being a weirdo here. I'm actually studying this. And then I was surprised because the guy's like, yeah, you know, sometimes I just come into this room and just stand there and stare at it. You know, I saw the entire collection of the Louvre, the entire collection of the Vatican Museum, National Gallery in London, museums in Edinburgh and in Dublin. And Dublin also has a Vermeer there. And DC. So all of this, I mean, it was just so much material. It was so much that, but I did learn a lot, because I remember specifically, like, coming back from that trip, and the first thing I painted when I came back was the Tree of Knowledge, the painting that has the glowing brain that's also an atomic explosion and flanked by two nude angels. You remember?
Yes. Oh, I was like, so, sure, we weren't talking about Klimt. We're talking about your...
Yeah, okay. And if you look at that painting, and when you see the way the glow is created around that fireball, it's a direct result of me studying.
Okay.
That was practical knowledge. And
I'm obsessed with time. So when did you start that painting?
I started it probably in 2009 or something like that. And I finished it in 2011. But that was the thing, you know, I had started it and I didn't know how to do certain things in it. Like, I wanted those effects and whatnot. But when I came back, I just boom, you know.
Okay.
I'm like, I know how to do this now. So which is kind of curious, because now I'm an expert at a number of techniques that I wouldn't have learned otherwise if I weren't teaching.
Right.
You know? So.
Oh, okay.
So, but it's not the first time that happened. That had happened before when I painted the portrait of Madonna, which is based on a photograph I saw in a magazine, because obviously I don't have her to sit for me. But
he's willing.
I decided that I wanted that piece to hang it in my house, you know, like there's a place where I want this painting, and like, but I didn't know how to paint in oils yet. You know, I had only done acrylics before. So it would be, you know, the photograph was published in 1998 and the painting that I made from it came in 2002 once I had mastered oils. But, and I say master, you know, quote unquote, but I mean, I could paint in oils, and it's the first time I ever painted a person.
Right. And it's one of your most popular ones. In fact, there's a story about it being stolen.
Yes.
Is that the one?
That's correct. Yeah.
At one of your parties, it just disappeared.
Yeah, well, after the party, we had a huge party. And then about a month later, people broke in and they took the painting and they took vacuum cleaner. Yeah, right? I was like, not the Dyson.
Maybe they came for the vacuum cleaner.
Yeah.
And then they're like, we're here.
Yeah, let's take that poster, you know. So but yeah, I was surprised. Yeah, the Rancho Cucamonga Police Department were kind of brilliant, and they found it. So they found it along with a whole bunch of other stuff that was all like stored away in a certain, it was a crazy story.
I'd like to believe that it was some like art thief that was slowly collecting.
No, there were several other pieces of art, yes.
Huh.
Yeah, it wasn't just me. It wasn't just, this was an organized effort.
Wow. You
know? Yeah.
It was kind of like a weird black market. Huh?
Yeah, and that even got on the news, you know. Mm-hmm. With the picture of the Madonna painting, you know, to talk about it, because it was like a countywide, you know, like there was a art being stolen everywhere. And,
wow.
So yeah, and once a painting, I mean, goes to the black market, like, forget it. Who's going to own up to having it, you know,
right,
until they die?
Which is weird. There's probably a real... I bet you somebody has, like, a really weird black market art gallery somewhere.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah, I mean, there are economies for everything you can think of. Yeah. So
do you have a preference for what medium you're... And I know you also do photography, so we don't want to just limit your conversation.
Well, see, I see... me as a producer of imagistic narrative, as opposed to just a visual artist that makes paintings or pictures. So like when you look at the way I write, for example, it's very visual, very visually descriptive, and I try to make my writings very evocative and dreamlike. And so that's for the future. One of my projects is to write a great story, but not a long one, you know, like a concise form. And so far, the one thing that has emerged the most clearly has been a story about me growing up in the Baja California desert, which was surreal from beginning to end. I mean, that there's so much to tell. As far as a preferred medium, as of now, it would be I would say it would be oils, mm-hmm. when they employ really delicate technique, you know, when you have to do like the I just did a reproduction of a portrait that was painted in 1940s by this Italian painter named Pietro Nigoni, and I wanted to teach myself, you know, as I teach people in the classroom, I also sort of identify which areas of my own practice could benefit from new knowledge. So I ran across the work of this painter, and there's another one, by the way, that I also want to learn from. His name is Shishkin, Ivan Shishkin, a Russian painter from the late 19th century, who made these incredible landscapes. So so I went to, you know, in art instruction, sometimes we do what's called master studies. You reproduce a work of art that was done by someone you admire, someone whose technique you want to learn. And the purpose of reproducing that work of art is that, hopefully, if all goes well, you run into the same problems and have to solve the same, have to face the same challenges that the original artist faced, you know. So it's like forced learning. I mean, you can approach a painting from so many different angles, you know, so many different perspectives, so many different sets of techniques. But I went for the real difficult one, which is called grisaille. You know, when you paint the image in black and white first, and then you lay thin glazes of color on it until you build up this translucency that looks like it emulates the look of human skin, mm-hmm. in the way it reflects light. It's incredibly tedious. It takes a long time. But I'm really happy with the result. I was really happy to do it because it's another tool in my tool belt. That's my favorite thing to do once the painting is done. But the process is like, thank God for YouTube, you know, thank God for Netflix. So that I can have, I always have something
YouTube
playing.
YouTube for something in the background and yes. Netflix. Okay. I
always.
Thought you meant like I got stuck in a painting and.
No. Every time when I'm painting, whenever I'm painting, I am always, you know, I used to listen to music, but that wasn't cutting it. So now what I do is I listen to lectures. I listen to lectures or I listen to talks. Stand-up comedy is great, but stand-up comedy has limited application if you know, if it deviates you from subject matter that you want to be focused on, you know. But yeah, I always have something playing in the background because it's a somehow there are people that can study listening to music, and I'm amazed by that. Okay, I can't do that. I could never.
Nice to meet you.
I can't focus on both. You know what I mean? It's like it's going to be one or the other.
So, I've got to the point where I, just to clarify for that, like where I'm like, I wish the teachers would let me listen to music while I do my test.
Oh,
because I study listening to music.
It's I guess it's a kind of stimulating or something. But I mean, I know of somebody who wrote a paper while listening to Adele. Like how? You know, I don't know. Yeah, that's not available to me. But I have discovered that I do have two completely separate channels for doing brushwork and listening and absorbing material without missing anything. I mean, I can really listen and I can be working, and those are completely separate from each other, you know.
And I'm sure subconsciously that influences some of what you're working on.
Well, yes and no. What it does do is it imprints itself onto the painting, you know. Like right. I can tell you in my painting of in Midnight in Paris, whenever I look at that bridge, I always think of Joan Rivers. Because that's what I was listening
rest
to.
Rest in peace.
Rest in peace, yes.
Or maybe she's not resting. Maybe she's like creating her own hell. Like, she's
well,
like,
you know.
Listen, Hitler.
That's the thing, you know, like she speaks to me from the grave and she makes me say some awful shit sometimes. So, yeah, she's busy. She's still busy.
I'm sure wherever she is, wherever the afterlife is, she's still got four TV shows. Just, yeah.
Very busy. I'm still opening doors and breaking down barriers. Everything converges. You know, I walked out of Mount SAC with a certificate, graphic design and photography, and which at the time we were right at the apex, at the transition between film and digital. I was actually there the very first semester when they told us, you no longer need to print in the darkroom. If you want to, you can develop the film. You have to develop the film still. But you can use the scanner to create a digital image and then use the digital printer. That was the, I was there when that was implemented.
The only thing I enjoyed about the photography class was the dark room, personally. Well, sorry.
Well, yeah, so many things happened there.
If you're the age of 13, turn it off now.
It's become a now it's become a work of art, you know, a form of actual organic element to it that makes it kind of exciting and makes it more unique. Because it's really rare now to see images that were printed in the darkroom, you know, that were chemically developed.
My nephew, who's 16, he's like has a photography class at high school, but it's all based upon using your phone.
Well, yeah, these phones are pretty amazing now. You know, they take pretty good video, pretty good pictures. Those tiny apertures give you amazing depth of field and so great color. I was really impressed with the Samsung phone that I had until it exploded, you know. So yes, I'm one of them. I'm one of those people that happened to. A really curious detail, I guess, is that when I was a toddler, when I was a little boy, my mom worked as a photographer in our hometown. There was one photography studio. And she worked at dark room, and I think she did like events, you know, like parties and things like that, as camera B. And so I still have her camera. You know, so I was always fascinated by that, you know, that she kept her camera and it was precious, and we never touched it, and she never used it, you know, while I was growing up.
Well, it was her working tool.
Yeah,
like that was very important.
So, but she stopped though when I was probably 4 or 5 years old. I mean, but I still I have tons of pictures of me as a baby because of that. You know, which is great. Unusual for that time, for that town too. But I was always fascinated by photography, and I remember I used to read Popular Mechanics when I was like 11, 12, and 13. You know, so I remember when the Canon EOS 1 came out. Oh my God, it was such a big deal, you know, this amazing machine. So it's really interesting to have the latest model of the EOS 1 in my hands today. Like it took 30 years, but I got it. And it's exactly the same body, you know, like the ergonomics of it are pretty fantastic. So
I guess another future podcast could be about the future of tech, like what that's going to look like or.
Yeah, it's a really interesting field in that technological strides are made on a constant basis, but the really big ones are more episodic. Like every maybe 5 years, there's a boom, here's a new sensor, the new generation of sensors. And so that's what I have now. It's like the latest. The longevity of it is expected to be good. So anyway, another story for another time. But the reason I got that camera is because I was going to take a video production class, and it was unfortunately canceled. So I'm learning on my own now. That's my next step. I want to play with video. So graphic design, I worked as a graphic designer for a better part of a decade. And the whole time I've been doing freelance photography, you know, and it's something that I should probably pursue more doggedly than I do now. Because I only take photography jobs when I'm called, when people literally approach me and they say, can you do this? Can you do that? You know, but I've done some pretty interesting things over the years. I have photographed artwork for art catalogs. I photographed the mayor of LA, Antonio Villaraigosa, at an event. You know, that was Televisa that hired me to do that.
And
I've documented a lot of artwork. That's one thing that I've become really good at taking images of art. You know, because I work for museums and whatnot and other artists, and so I'm really good at color matching. And so the graphic design and the photography and the art history and all of these things sort of converge together into everything that I do. Every time that I finish a painting, there's information from all sides, from these fields, you know, and that's in terms of color choices, in terms of layout, in terms of composition or whatnot, you know. And I use a lot of my own photography and sometimes other people's photography as reference for the things that I do, you know. So
I mean, nowadays, a lot of people, like, even when you go back to your Tree of Life, like, you take photographs of the models.
No, the Tree of Life is next.
Oh.
That was the Tree of Knowledge.
Tree of Knowledge that, I know I'm a terrible host, that you photograph the model.
Yes. I still and those were only two images, by the way, that I used out of the batch of, like, 100.
I want to get into, you know, you talked about earlier about you used art to help you cope and deal with things. Mm-hmm. And how do you, that process happens for a lot of people to kind of a way to get through things.
Yeah, there's you know, my first understanding of that was when I was in high school. I was friends with the school psychologist because I was always fascinated by psychology, by the way. And one of the things to this day, you know, and one of the things that I did outside of the high school is that I would hide in the library. and I read almost every book in that library, but I ran into this the Encyclopedia of Psychology, and it covered Freud and it covered Jung and it covered more recent personality theories and things like that. And that in one of the volumes, I remember seeing a painting by Salvador Dali, and it spoke about how, you know, the surrealists, they were really interested in the subconscious and in expressing through images the things that are sort of partially articulated in our subconscious and kind of bringing them to the surface. So they were really interested in the dream, and they were really interested in the cognitive structures that are under the surface that end up driving your behavior and you're not even aware of them. And so that was really fascinating to me, and that's part of the reason why my art took a turn in that direction, because you can clearly see surrealist influence in some of my work. So it was a very deliberate thing that I did with the drawings, you know, while I was going through, you know, my mother's illness and her passing on, and just your own sort of emerging identity as a teenager and the angst that you have against the world. And but I didn't feel quite as oppressed as your average teenager would have in such a conservative little town, because I was pretty much free to do what I wanted, you know, like I. So the drawings, they helped me to deal with things, and they also helped me to capture things in a subjective manner. I mean, if you go through them, you will see episodes of my life there, you know, like one day I'll publish them. Like, they're still kind of raw and hard for me to look at, but something for later. But that process evolved, you know, as you evolve as a human being, as a person, and you grow and you have new experiences and whatnot, and what remained of that was sort of understanding that you can reach into the depths of your mind and express something and therefore understand it better, you know? Sometimes you don't know what you're feeling or you're thinking it, but if you're able to make art about it, you develop a better relationship with it, you know?
Right, and sometimes like a normal thing in therapy is to like journal.
Yeah.
For you, it was drawing is, yes, I guess what I'm trying to get at.
And and I also keep a dream journal, by the way, because I'm a very vivid dreamer. Like, my dreams are crazy and incredibly realistic, and I'm almost what do you call a lucid dreamer? You know, because like when I'm falling asleep, it's literally like I'm walking into some other place, and then the story begins to unfold. And you know, sometimes I remember, sometimes I don't. But the really vivid ones, I do remember, and I keep a journal because I draw from that as well. So yeah, the art as a coping mechanism it does play a role, but not at this point in my life. I don't cope with things by making art about them any longer. I have a specific mission for the things that I create now. Mm-hmm. You know, a specific goal, which is it's beginning to articulate itself.
Well, one thing about that cognitive time in your life as a teenager, though, is you're learning how to kind of interact with the real world, and you're not in control of your life, your childhood then.
Yeah.
Now your life is much more, you know, what are we making for breakfast?
Right.
Those are
the grave decisions of the day.
Right. Well, let me ask you another thing that I've learned from you as far as you talking about images or drawings kind of helping you process the world, that like when we watch films, I don't think of things as images.
No.
You know, and supposedly early pictographs and stuff do, you know, like the sun plus a hand equals a something.
Well, yeah, but that's what you just mentioned is the emergence of a system of writing,
okay,
which is different from subjective imagery. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I come to understand, and it took me a while, by the way, of thinking about this, because my favorite type of film is science fiction. And it really is at the top of my of the things that I like to
watch. So like a top three films that you want to...
Oh, God. Blade Runner 2049, oh, right away. Who are we kidding here? I love Prometheus. I loved how convoluted and weird a story that was. You know, right, how everybody was like, what? Did I just and how does this fit in the larger narrative? Like, and
just to fill people in, the problem that we've recognized is that in we're watching the director commentary, mm-hmm. like that everyone's going to watch the seven people in a dark house with a monster.
Yeah.
But Ridley Scott's now doing a mythology story.
Yeah. Yeah.
An origin story there.
So it was perhaps a little much to ask of the audience, but I do believe it was a necessary step for him to bring the work to the place where he wants it to be.
You know? Right.
Which, so, and also definitely, someone like David Lynch, the films that he makes are fascinating to me. They're like these incredible poems, mm-hmm. you know? The reason, though, I like science fiction films is because they deal imaginatively with the future. You know, they place our very human circumstance in these extraordinary situations that we may or may not encounter at some point, and we kind of work out how we're going to make our way through them. One of the things about painting that absolutely fascinates me, you know, it's been declared at various points during the 20th century that painting is dead. And painting is dead, and painting is dead, and painting, and it certainly dies, I guess, in certain people's minds.
Right.
And sure, well, suit yourselves, you know. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, painting treks on. It continues. It continues to be produced, and it continues to manifest itself in the world. And there is a curious point in human history. There's a point in the past which you cannot see. We don't have evidence of the earliest humans. As far as the anthropological record goes, it's estimated that the anatomically modern humans are at least a quarter of a million years old, something like that, between 200, 250,000 years. And the particular configuration that is us today with this voice box, and mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. about 100,000 years old. That's my understanding. And the oldest work of art that we know of is about 40,000 years old. Now, it's the oldest one because it's the oldest one that was preserved. But that means that art dates back way beyond that. I mean, and civilization really begins, what, about 10,000 years ago when, you know, people begin aggregating, the agriculture emerges and all of these things. So art emerged along with human consciousness. And all the surviving examples of it are paintings, you know. Mm-hmm. When I was looking at this picture of I think it's Chauvet in France, this cave painting that I believe it's about 32,000 years old. And it's a herd of lions, and there's some animals, you know, that they're chasing. And so, I mean, I think about just the fact that there were lions in Europe alone. It's kind of mind-boggling. And I'm looking at this, you know, this dynamic representation of the natural world, and it just occurred to me, that's not just a picture, you know. That's not something that somebody stood there and made a painting of, and okay, I'm done, I'm leaving now, or like, people come look at this. They put a label down there, you know, charge for admission. You know?
They had like box of wine.
And, cheese and crackers and art critics, you know. No, I think what it seems like to me, like that is just a piece of something larger. I don't know, this came to me instinctively, like somebody was telling a story here, okay, using right. these pictures. They probably... And this was probably something that went on for a long yeah. time, reenacting a certain story about the animals or about the hunt or about whatnot. It's like, and I'm like looking at this cave painting thinking, it's a movie. It's yeah. a movie. We've been making movies for 30,000 years, you know? Like,
if we all know, it's just a frustrated dad that was yeah. like, don't let the tigers eat you.
But you know what I mean by that? You know, it's an imagistic narrative.
Right.
It's just a primitive one, you know?
Like a fairy tale.
Yeah. And somehow... There's a narrative embedded in it, and that was probably either told verbally or acted out or whatever. You know, so
you feel like this connects a little bit to Ridley Scott then, and what he's trying to tell.
It connects in a huge way, you know, because people are fascinated by film. You know, so I mean, they're all
it's the literature of the time.
Yeah.
Like there's, you know, we would have had Charles Dickens, but now we have, well, unfortunately, we have Star Wars. Well, I love Star Wars.
Well, no.
The Disney version of it is not as entertaining to me, and not as a purist, if
no,
I may add.
And there's, you know, obviously there's room for everything. You know, there are people in this world. There is, let's say, a certain branch of academia that would be very happy, very, very happy for self-preservation purposes to be able to divide what is being taught at the high-level art schools from what's happening in pop culture, saying that's not art. You know, that's pop stuff, you know, the films and the... and the music and the whatnot. That's not real art. Art is what's happening inside of this tiny little white cube, you know?
Oh, right.
And that's fine. That's fine, you know, charge your students $50,000 a year for that.
Limited. Probably more now.
Yeah, and but in the meantime, the art continues to develop. It just happens outside of the academic world now, and it just treks on. You know, like the directors, they don't care. You know, they're gonna make what they're gonna make. Creators are gonna make what they're gonna make, and people will come if they're fascinated by it enough. You know, so but I don't believe for a second that there isn't a progression in Western culture that connects directly to ancient history, to ancient Western world history, you know? It just, I feel that there was somewhere mid 20th century, there was a sort of split, you know, to the sort of elitist art world that became academic and whatnot, and then the art world that became more like popular, you know? And right. The two things are kind of merging now, and I see it even here in Los Angeles, you know, with people returning to more traditional forms of representation and whatnot, but... I'm just an observer of all this, you know. Right. It doesn't really influence what I do or what I'm interested in.
Well, we're all kind of got a window to society with the internet in a way that we didn't before. That like you could be 50 miles away and still see what other people are doing.
Yeah, YouTube is a fantastic window into the world in that sense. You know,
and YouTube is a good example of. People don't want to sit there and open a book when someone else will just tell you what it says. You know?
Yeah, right. I still read, you know. I love certain types of literature. I was in Alaska recently, and I was at a used bookstore in Homer, and I ran into this book called Arctic Dreams by Barry Lopez. And I opened it, and I just, you know, my friend was there looking for something specific, you know. And I was just browsing, you know, I was just bored, and walking around looking at, and I just opened this book casually, and I immediately fell in love with the language that this man uses to describe the land. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm buying this. This is beautiful, you know? So I paid $8 for that book, found out later that they sell for like 20, you know? Mm-hmm. And I picked it because of the way it is written specifically, you know? And it's very visual, you see? So I'm reading that now. I told my friend, look, this book, I mean, God, it's the language, the way this man is describing everything. He's like, oh, yeah, that's a staple here. You know, everybody has one in their coffee table. I'm like, oh, okay. that little incident really helped. I felt connected, you know, I guess the population there or something. So one of you know, I have a painting program now. You know, there's a certain place where I'm going with my work. I was able to merge these separate sets of ideas that I've been kind of toying around and investigating. And I do a lot of research. I do a lot of online reading and a lot of looking at images of certain things, you know. So I compiled amassed all of this material, and I was able finally to distill it into a coherent vision for future work and pulling from all directions, you know. So right now, when you look at my paintings, and if you go to my website and look at my paintings page, you're gonna find that there are some thematic resonances between them, but they're all about different things. I mean, there's the portraits, there's the landscapes, there's the surreal, impossible things. But I've only recently came to understand those are like the borders of the landscape, my cognitive landscape that I'm working with, and everything that's inside hasn't been expressed yet. You know?
Something for another time is magical realism or the non-existence of it.
Well. Magical realism, I think it's better understood as a literary movement. When, you know, Isabel Allende recently said that magical realism was dead, and she was one of the exponents of, you know, Gabriel García Márquez, and because it originates in South America, you know, with this incredible writers. And she said something to the effect of, yeah, it's done, it's over. And I'm like, no, just because you can't write a book anymore. I'm kidding, Isabel, I'm kidding. I'm joking.
Just another podcast killing a career.
It's a mild day. So that translated somehow into paintings as well. You know, one of the painters that I was looking at early on when I was learning to paint was Michael Parks. Because then I was fascinated by the work. I was fascinated by the technique more than anything. Interesting thing about Michael Parks was the way he shaped his career. You know, because he was able to work within a gallery system for some time and then became his self-published. He became his own publisher. And you know, when as recently as, I believe, a couple of years ago when he, at the art fair in LA, you know, he had a booth there, and it was literally like you go to the Michael Parks booth and it's Michael Parks behind the desk, you know, like, so I like that model. I like that independence, you know.
Not, I'm like, not, what's his name? Kincaid or?
Thomas Kincaid. you know, we talked about Thomas Kincaid in one of my classes, because what happened with him, well, it was very sad, obviously, but it goes to show how cynical we can be about things, you know. It was estimated at some point that one in every four American homes had a piece by Thomas Kincaid. You know, he's wildly successful. I mean, this person getting in private jets and going from gallery to gallery to do signings and, you know, fascinating people, and also having a difficult personal life and whatnot. But I've heard some things from some artists about him just mocking whatever, but like, don't tell me you wouldn't want that. Don't tell me that that's not a dream come true for a painter. For
haters, painter. Gonna hate though. Yeah. Like, people are, it's so easy for people to go, that's not what my art's gonna do.
Yeah, no, and it's so materialistic and so superficial and so repetitive. And yes, it is all of those things. Are you that successful? You know, and can you just live and let live? You know, like, why do you have to tear down another person? Like, I don't understand that. But anyway, it did get to him in the end. I mean, he drank himself to death or something. You know, like, wow. It's so...
I'm going to have to research that.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about his personal life. His paintings are so cheery. They're so...
Well, he tapped into something. He tapped into a demographic. I wouldn't have one on my wall, but I don't... But I can see where they fit. You know what I mean? And it allowed the average American that doesn't have a specialized education to feel that they owned something truly representative of the word fine art, right. You know? He made that possible for a lot of people. Same thing with people who make fun of Bob Ross. Like, sure, he painted the same thing over and over.
He's kind of a hero now, though. Yeah,
but he brought but there's still cynicism, you know what I mean? Like, he brought the joy of painting to so many people. Like, so these popularizers of art, they have their role, you know? They play a part. Let them play their part, right. You know? I mean, that's not something I aspire to do, or that I would like, you know. I'm interested in teaching painting to people who are really interested in learning. That's really, I get an enormous sense of satisfaction from that. If you are serious, if you want to learn to paint, I can teach you. I can teach anybody.
Do you think about doing online classes someday?
Yes, actually, I'm kind of structuring that, and the Dot Center for the Arts, we're working on. We're going to create a more formalized teaching environment. So, because we have classes in painting, ceramics, and drawing, you know, so we can, there's enough elements to create like a small art academy, you know. The lectures that I prepared for some of my classes are, they probably could find an audience online. I have a series on the cultural and historical significance of color, of each color.
Wow.
You know, from the beginning of time, you know. So the earliest pigments, obviously, were the ones that were created for the cave paintings, you know, and those are almost directly taken from the land, you know, iron oxide and whatnot. And then, you know, each subsequent pigment emerging and how it gets degraded into society. Blue is one of the oldest, you know, lapis lazuli was used in sculpture, and it was ground down to use as a pigment, although it was not quite as intense that way because it gets kind of chalky. But a curious thing about the pigments is that once they enter culture, they change things. You know, like, for example, the armies are interested in uniforms that are certain colors, you know, so the government immediately like, oh, you can make fabric that color, come over here, you know. So you see all of these things like sort of shifting at the points in which a pigment enters the market. Really fascinating stuff to look at. So I think I could probably make some videos about that.
Well, let's get towards the end now. And I mean, normally I'm going to ask people who are their heroes, but we cover most of that. But I know for you, your thing is a little bit more of a theoretical, what heroes have been throughout history.
This idea of, I like this, never meet your heroes, you know, because why? What's going to happen? You're going to find out they're all too human, right?
Right.
So, in some form or another.
Unless it's Cher.
Right. Yeah, oh, she's still alive. Who are my heroes?
It doesn't have to be heroes. Sometimes it's just somebody that you like look up to, or you like realize, hey, like I could do that. Or I could do it better.
I like David Lynch.
Right.
I like David Lynch because he's so weird, so unique. You know, he's so and he's, I think, one thing that we could all benefit from being, which is pretty fearless. You know, he will put the weird stuff out there and just you deal with it, you know. So I like that. Well, the you mean in the, like the archetypal sense of what yeah. the hero is? Well,
like for me, it was Joseph Campbell just saying like the ideal, like even the Jesus figure who continues for the last 2,000 years, in which even like Ridley Scott kind of is still, when you talk about the ancient being in the yeah. in the modern, we still keep bringing these up about this savior that's gonna, even now in the current time, we keep waiting for somebody
yeah.
to save us, and that's a dangerous story yeah, that we keep telling ourselves
yeah. because you cast this messianic role on a very fallible person, and yeah, well, just look around you. I think Jesus, for example, embodies one of, in my understanding, is he embodies one of the highest qualities a human being can have, which is sacrifice yourself for the benefit of all,
right?
Everyone, everything, you know. And you give up your life, you know, and you see that. I mean, that's an archetypal behavior, and you know? You see that resonating in film. I mean, even God, something crazy like Black Swan, you know, like yeah, it was perfect. I felt it. It was perfect. But she had to die to perform, you know, like so it's then there's a certain redemptive quality, dying for the cause, that continues to be tapped into. Remember that mm-hmm. that film Passengers with Jennifer what's her last name? Jennifer Lawrence?
Yeah. And Chris Pratt.
Yeah. I mean, that movie was trashed.
I didn't see it, but I heard that the premise of like her being woken from her cryogenic sleep
yeah.
to kind of just give up her chance to go to be off planet.
He woke her up because he was lonely and he was in love with her and she was asleep there, Sleeping Beauty. So it's Sleeping Beauty. He steals her life and whatnot, but it's like the people who wrote the more condemning pieces of against this narrative conveniently neglect the other half of the story. That's not the complete story. The complete story is if they hadn't awoken, everyone would have died. Everyone on that ship. Mm-hmm. That ship was destined to just burn up, mm-hmm. and the fact that they're both of them were awake is what saved everyone else. You know, and in the movie, Chris Pratt dies. He dies and he comes back to life.
Spoiler.
Hey, well, you're not going to watch it anyway.
I'm not.
maybe we should put warning spoilers, film spoilers in
the... I don't believe in that.
No. But you know, so he pays the price and she brings him back. So I think the what enraged certain demographics more than anything else was the fact that she actually genuinely fell in love with him. Like, no, that is, you know, that is he gets rewarded for bad behavior, sure, but he's gonna die, you know. I don't know. So it is these complex moral issues that are embedded in films are really interesting to me, and I think condemning the film is the wrong thing to do.
Oh yeah,
discuss it, you know.
Yeah,
work it out. So that's a riddle
coming up. And even with the podcast Never Meet Your Heroes, some of it is because we're in this film genre, the larger one, where we're doing superhero movies
oh, yeah.
over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure someone's going to be able to figure that out once we're dead, why we're so obsessed with these right now. But there is to me a small connection with, because we keep telling these messianic, as you call it, stories. Like part of what we enjoy when we get towards the end of the like Guardians of the Galaxy 2. There's
No spoilers.
No, I don't have to spoil it, but I don't have to spoil it because you already kind of know the formula. Someone's right. going to sacrifice themselves.
Oh yeah, someone did.
Everyone's
going to
cry and be like, "We lost our hero," and then ta-da, he comes back
yeah.
because we need to make another one.
Yeah,
and because right. we need to see Chris Pratt with the shirt off again.
Right. So yeah, so to me the more heroic efforts today in the arts are probably in film, and because it does take a village to create a film and it employs thousands of people, it entertains millions, and it's embedded in the culture, and people get together for it, and it's an incredible force, you know, and right. this narrative form, you know. But I don't study films, or I don't watch films with the intent of then coming back to my easel and painting something that I saw. You know what I mean?
It's okay.
Like, it's not like that. It's more I'm more interested in the structure of it and observing what's happening. So I'm a great observer of life.
Okay.
Let's say, and hopefully that will permeate into the work in a clearer form, because everything that I've done up to now, very organic and very I just kind of let things find their way out into the world, you know, and a bit more of a plan now. Mm. And I pulled up some of my work here. I wanted to show you this.
Well, one thing to know, too, because you've been in the industry for a while, is, you know, even with the idea of heroes, you kind of come in bushy-eyed and you kind of are, like, looking forward to finding your community. And some of the people that have been there before you might have been jaded or just they're not as much help as you would hope them to be, and eventually you kind of walk away realizing, oh, I didn't need that person. I guess
no,
we don't get a lot of that story. It's like, yeah, you don't really need. It's better for you to not wait for somebody to save you.
Well, exactly, and be your own hero, right?
Right.
In the arts, it's a very small world, and it's a really strange world, and I think. We are very naive at the beginning, you know, that when like the people that I studied with initially that were in school at the same time that I was, there was a lot of promising talent there, you know, and then here we are, what, 15 years later.
Don't you feel like it's better to find your peers and just support each other rather than necessarily having someone lift you up?
Absolutely. Yes. And definitely. You can. Of course, it's important to undertake mentorships just to learn. But rather than being lifted up by someone, to learn how things work, mm-hmm. to learn how artists live, what sustains them from the inside, you know, mm-hmm. What sacrifices have they made? Because they all do. We all do in some form or another. There's things you have to give up. So being persistent at it is really important. But certainly. The thing with the art landscape, and because the universe is so vast and there's so much to explore and so much to think about and so much to talk about, is that in the end we set off kind of like miners, you know, like lone wolves, you know, everybody goes in a different direction to dig over there and you dig over there and to try to, you know, come up with ideas and bring them back into culture and express them for the rest of the world to see. So I recently learned an interesting definition of what artists do, is that we go into the unknown and we sort of mine it and we re-express it in partially articulated form. That's what makes some paintings so fascinating, is because you almost get it. You're almost connected to this mystery, but it doesn't quite give itself to you immediately, you know? And those are the works that I like the most. My favorite painting in the world, by the way.
Excellent. Making my job so easy.
Well, The Sleeping Gypsy by Henri Rousseau. Painted, I believe, in 1898. And it's a dream landscape. And it's a surrealist painting way before the surrealists came up, you know. And if you look back even further, around the year 1500...
If this was a hip-hop battle, you totally just dissed Dolly.
Well, you know, he was working with a certain set of ideas, you know, like you gather things and this is what I'm going to build my identity upon, right? So he had a lot more to draw from than Rousseau did. Rousseau drew from his imagination, you know. Dalí had the entire branch of psychoanalysis to work with, you know. But if you go back further and you look at Hieronymus Bosch, Garden of Earthly Delight, he was literally out there, you know, with the paintings. But again, you know, there's you can really hone in into a set of, not only a set of topics, things that fascinate you, but also forms that work for you, that are good at expressing the things you're concerned with. So it gets to anybody out there who is struggling with whether I should or shouldn't paint, do it, don't stop, you know. Because if you stop, it's only, you're going to go back to it anyway a few years from now. And you're going to be like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have, you know, like, don't stop.
Also the discipline. It's like you said, like, it took you about 2 years to finish that one. And I know you didn't work on it day and night. But
now, let me tell you a little bit about the experience of teaching art. For me, that has been probably the most transformative. Of everything I've done, it's had the most impact, because I came to the classroom with a certain set of skills, right? And a kind of a system for conveying them to the students, right? But in working with these different people, because the way we run this class, it's like an atelier. It's an open studio. You bring your own projects. You tell me what you want to accomplish, and I help you figure out how to do it, or flat out tell you how to do it, mm-hmm. and guide you through the process, right? In doing so, I have had to solve problems that I never would have encountered on my own. You know, I've had to figure how to render certain things or how to paint certain things. So I've learned a lot from having to solve problems for other people. And the result of that was that, you see this painting here? Mm-hmm. It's called Amor de Pescador, Fisherman's Love. It's based on a photograph that my sister took with her phone in Baja California, right. in the desert. Yeah. And I saw it and I love the composition. And there were more things in it, so I made it simpler. There was a person in there and whatnot. I love the desolation, the rural decay mm-hmm. in it, and the poetry. That's right. that phrase is by there's this movement called Acción Poética where they tag buildings
okay.
with poetry phrases, and you don't sign with just lines from poems or with like beautiful sayings or uplifting things. And with nice handwriting, you know.
I wish that would happen here in LA.
Yeah, and instead of tagging it with your name or whatever, it has to be anonymous. You just mm-hmm. put the hashtag Acción Poética, mm-hmm. which is poetic action. You know?
The painting is like a white brick building with some rotting wood, a old ship, and a really beautiful light blue background there.
Well, it's almost, you know, this is in a seaside town,
okay,
right? And there's so much that converges in this image, you know, like it's memories from the place where I grew up, the desert, the colors, they're all there, the merciless sun. I mean, it bleaches everything.
You could see the yellow that you kind of got from the sunlight.
But also the fact that it's... I asked my sister for permission before reproducing it. I told her, you know, this is beautiful. I want to make a painting from it because it says so much about where we grew up, the kind of things we saw, the kind of environment, and the sort of, there's a certain sadness to it, but also hope in the form of the poetry. Yeah, I'd add even
just a culture of art because the fact that there's like this little poet.
And it's in Mexico, you know, mm-hmm. so which people in Mexico, I feel they're a little more directly connected to the arts than mm-hmm. here, you know, and that's partly because of art here has become such a sort of a superior inferior kind of thing, you know, like it's an academic thing or whatnot, you know. So
a lot of people come to LA to make it and prove that they're better than the small town that they came from. And
so I know we have a very specific mentality here, and I think it's conducive to a lot of things, not all of them good. So where I was going with this is that I made this painting in 2 days.
Wow.
2 days, all that detail.
Okay.
You know, and that's because I've learned some things, you know, like I've figured some things out, and that's acrylics, by the way. Okay. I normally paint in oils. That was done in acrylics, and I just turned it out, and I was really happy with it in the end. I'm like, okay, cool, you know. So this, you see this, obviously, there's the other side of the world, a picture of Paris, but it relates to this images. You see the colors there, except that these are nightscapes.
Right,
but they're all also from the desert. This is
the color of the sand, and then
poem one and poem two.
But in this one, the mountains are blue.
Yes, those were the mountains that you could see from where I grew up.
Okay,
they're that color, but that's the aesthetic. And if you notice, the palette's pretty consistent. Again, here something dilapidated in the desert, you know. And this is my homage to Salvador Dali, mm-hmm. and this very specifically, you know, definitely it's called The Visionary, and this painting very much speaks about the place where I grew up and the sort of things that I imagined that I would like to encounter if I went out into the desert at night, which I often did. Mm-hmm. You know?
And there's something going even back with your sci-fi. There's something that, like, even if you went to another planet, you might imagine that
maybe you'd see
a plant like that doing that.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, like, I'm recently, you know, right now I have a show up in Los Angeles at the Hive Gallery. Well, that you were there, huh? Of course.
You're not part of the art world if you're not being seen.
I was really happy when those paintings went up, because they're so different, you know, and they touch upon different things, that they make sense together still, regardless, right. You know, they're consistent. I'm like, okay, I do have a language. That's great, you know. And you don't see it unless you see them all together, you know, like, because you're so focused on the one image that you're working with. You know? So I do invite you all to visit my website, angelvillanueva.com.
And if you have any questions, you can go ahead and post them to our nevermeetyourheroespodcast.com, where it can direct you to our Facebook, which you can look up as well, Twitter and Instagram. And thank you, Angel, for speaking with me today. And we look forward to speaking with you again and kind of covering some other topics that we didn't get to today.
Sounds great.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for listening to Never Meet Your Heroes podcast. You can find us at nevermeetyourheroespodcast.com. Post comments, ask questions, and interact with artists and listeners on Facebook at Never Meet Your Heroes Podcast, Twitter at Never Meet Heroes, Instagram at Never Meet Your Heroes Podcast, or by email at nevermeetyourheroes@gmail.com.